George, you know, you'd be really under the impression we're a real radio station if you saw this, you know? Almost, come on, just bring it up there. That's it. Oh, don't do it. Keep it up. Up, 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 up. Bury me. That's it. There you go. There you go. Very good. All right, George. I'm very proud of the engineering department. It's only taken them 12 years since I came here. Of course, we've got the same old cannonball headset here that John Gambling Sr. used in his first exercise program. That's all right. Just beggars can't be choosers, you know. Got to see the gold headsets the day people have. They don't need headsets. They never listen to what they do. It's not necessary. Yes, indeed. Imagine what would happen. John Gambling Jr. was forced to listen to him. There we go, friends, neighbors, fellow sufferers. All right, look at this thing work here. I'm going to try it and see how it sounds on FM here. Well, it's not as loud on FM. How come? Well, that's a cheap FM transmitter. Have you ever listened to us on FM? We got an 18 dB hum over S9. It's very good, though. Kind of nice. We work it into the arrangements of the music and everything, you know. Well, I'm back now, and for those of you who've wondered why I've been on tape for the last couple of weeks, it's because I was bent on a feckless mission. I said feckless, and it was what a scene. Oh, boy. Would you please bring my salute to the British Empire music up, please? Yes, hit it real hard there. Bring it up. Oh, bring it up. Oh, those soaring gothic buttresses that you see on every street in London. They never heard from the girdle and soaring gossip. Yes, and tonight we salute the British Empire. I just got back from England, and I was there for 2 weeks. And you know, it's funny, every time I'm off, go somewhere, and somebody listens to a tape that they heard 2 years ago, they get mad. They think they've been cheated. Listen, you're getting it free, Dad, and you should be lucky. You should be glad. I'm telling you, I know one guy that went back to see How to Succeed Without Even Trying, or whatever that was, what that show was called. He went back to see it 9 times, and they did the same show for him every time. He paid $18 a seat every time he saw it and thought he was getting the bargain at that. Rotten show. And so, you know, you're getting it free, and every time I go away, everybody seems to think that I'm sick. I always get this letter from all kinds of people say, "Dear Mr. Shepherd, I hope you feel better. And we enjoyed your kazoo playing, and we hope you feel better." Well, that's true. You do feel a little sick if you spend much time in England in certain quarters. Do you admit there, old man, Jeff, that I'll tell you, if they think, listen, most American writers I know don't know really much about the world. They have never really been much in the world. And they measure the world by Teaneck, from whence they came, and by McDougal Street, from whence they are now festering. And they really do believe that you know that they know, to read the average American publication today, whether I don't care what magazine it is, hard hitting satire magazine, anything. How's your hard hitting satire out there, friend? I've been really blasting the boss lately. I'm glad to be back. I mean, a fantastic satire in the men's room that you do, back of the water machine there. It better not be heard, though. I'm sure that that kind of stuff won't go over in the Blue Angel. But while we're on the subject of satire, it's very hard, when you've really been someplace, to accept the premise that America is a sick society. I say that if we define America as a sick society, we better invent another word for Britain. Oh, man, I'll tell you, about every 30 seconds on the street, you pass guys with their hair down to their waist, you know. In fact, I know one of the singing groups that I was involved with, a bunch of them went to get a haircut the other day. And they're called the Pretty Things. And they sat down. One of the guys said, the barber says, how do you want it, sir? And he says, trim it a little, just around the waist. And it's an insane society, I'll tell you. You don't hear much of that side of Britain. You really don't. About all we hear about from Britain is Peter Cook, Jonathan Miller, and maybe Sir Laurence Olivier. But there is another side to Britain, friends, and it's big and big and getting bigger, I'll tell you. Oh, man, I'll tell you. Some night after the election and everything, I'm going to spend about 3 weeks talking about this side of London. And for those of you who wonder what I was doing, I did too, from time to time, wonder what I was doing. I was traveling with the Beatles throughout the British Isles. This is not quite as simple as you might seem to think. You know, offhand you think, well, it really isn't. Or don't you think it's simple, friend? It wasn't this. Although sometimes I thought I was pretty simple for doing it along the line. However, I was traveling with the Beatles, and I was the first person from America who'd ever actually traveled with them in their home territory. And you get pretty sick of quoits after a while, I can tell you. And you get sick and tired of watching rotten television between every show. You know, they sit in their dressing room and watch TV with their mouths hanging open. And they do, literally. Isn't that true, Jeff? Jeff, you've worked with them. And you know, it's funny how an image is built up. The image in America is that the Beatles are very funny. Well, I think they're roughly about as funny as four average subnormal truck drivers. they're totally unfunny, actually. But the image has been created, and that's the end of it. It's gonna persist till the end of time. And about the typical average Beatle comment is, "Oh, go mucking around with my drums." That's about all you hear, and that's a typical Beatle mo. And of course, the journalist who hears that says, Ringo, in his typical dry manner, said. And you wonder really about the world of journalism when you get close to it. And of course, the Beatles accepted me as a fellow performer, so I was able to get by with a lot that nobody else would. And we traveled around and spent, no, that's true, we traveled 4 and 5 hours at a clip in that crummy old car they've got. They've got a Princess. An Austin Princess, which has seen its best days, I'll tell you. And they go whistling over the roads with this guy driving them. They got a guy who's made out of concrete who drives them around and under strictest security. It is always suspected that somebody's about to assassinate a Beatle, which could in its own way be a creative act at this day and age, but nevertheless, we went from theater to theater. We were in Birmingham, and that was the original Birmingham, friends. It's even dirtier than the one we've got, if anything. It's amazing to think that there's a crummier city than our Birmingham. There is. I was in it. I was in Leeds and Manchester and Liverpool. Liverpoolian! I even learned to talk a fairly acceptable Liverpool accent. I got along fine with them after a while. What you do is sort of, when you talk Liverpool, you make a sound like as if you got a big mouth of 8-hour chewing plug in your mouth, and you're trying to get it around. You go, well, I think that's all right. That's about the way they talk. Is there something like it? They sort of cough it out and belt it out. And they have a curious way of expressing themselves. They have two words which they use over and over again. It's almost the total Liverpool vocabulary. It reminded me of the Army, as a matter of fact. A great deal of the Army there. And I traveled around. I was on assignment for a popular male magazine that features a fold-out. It's amazing to say that whenever you're in England and you say you're from Playboy, everyone turns green. And immediately they hand you Christine Keeler's phone number. That's the truth. And I came into a place called the Ad Lib, you know, Jeff, in London. It's a shifty underworld den. And, you people don't know that what kind of an exciting life I lead when I'm not here making with the stuff here about leader. But I walked in there, and the guy at the door said, you're from Playboy. There's Mandy Rice Davies over there. And sure enough, Mandy Rice Davies was sitting over there. She was on the knee of an ex-prime minister. And I knew that British culture had come a long way since Richard the Lionhearted. And I'll tell you, there's a lot about Britain that I'd like to report, and I will report. And I'm always amused at the wonderful reports that you get back. I think the American traveler is the only traveler in the world, and that includes journalists, who really sees very little when he goes to a country. He only sees the good. He does. He really does. He comes back, and he raves about Stratford, and yet he never talks about the other side of Stratford. Boy, there is another side of Stratford, I'll tell you, and I met her. I'll tell you. The backside there. And I met her in the Ad Lib, and we'll talk about that some night when the kiddies are in bed. However, what we often think of is another culture. I think America is the only people in the world today, I really do, who literally spend most of their time, whether it's in politics, whether it's in satire, art, fiction, you name it, breastfeeding, bearing its soul, and proclaiming to the heavens how rotten it is. And, of course, everybody around it agrees. You go to England, you go to France, they all agree loudly because it lets them off the hook. You rarely hear anybody in Britain ever actually looking around and you know, looking at his place. He may talk about this political figure or that political figure, but, oh, wow. I would love to be a satirist in the British Isles right now today. I'm serious, because there is so much fantastic material around. Unbelievable, incredible material. Ranging all the way. You talk about the exchange of the roles of the sexes. We've talked about it here. They've already traded in Britain. They've traded completely. True, Jeff? And they're coming all the way back around again. There were two men found the other day on Hyde Park Square who were acting like men. They were arrested. You can't stand for this kind of terrible perversion going on. But it's a wild scene, I'll tell you. I was walking. In fact, I was with a guy, another American, and we followed two chicks for over 17 blocks, all around Grosvenor Square and up and down by the park there, and past the Dorchester Hospital, where we discovered it was two guys who played in a band, and they were on their way to their hairdresser. And they were trailing what smelled like, actually the scent was spring arbutus. I recognized that. And it was two guys from a band. And it was a wild scene. So it's just Britain on a yard wide. You know, and speaking of wild scenes, I really came back because of the election. I was in, I'm going to vote. And I was in Britain during the election, their big recent election. And they have a very different attitude towards elections there. It's kind of ho-hum. it is. They really don't get excited. It's funny. They were so fascinated to find that everybody in America was interested in their election. They really were. And I kept saying, what do you think of the election? They'd go, I'd say, well, what do you think of the new Labour government? Wait and see. That's about all there was to it. I could get nobody stirred up. Nobody threatened to leave the country because everybody else had another scene going. He had his own little Mandy Rice Davies stashed away somewhere, and he wasn't worried about economic balances of trade. speaking of Ladies of Easy Virtue, this is WOR, AIM and FM New York, and we'll be here for a while. This is old friendly Fred. And while we're on the subject of voting, they've been plugging all day long on the air that you should get out and vote. Well, this is one guy who says there's a lot of you shouldn't. I've heard a lot of you discuss politics, and I'm worried when I think of you guys voting. I'm really serious. You know, they seem to think here in America that voting in itself is a positive virtue. In fact, I heard one spot by some friendly lady who does a program here on WOR that seemed to say, in spite of the fact you don't know anything about it, and don't let that stop you. Get out and vote. And thereby, you will nullify the vote of somebody who does know something about it, you know. And you'll get your little foot in the oar there, and the next thing you know, you got a Hitler. Well, all right. I'm just really saying, voting itself, friends, is not a virtue. And if you don't, Walter Kiernan was implying that tonight. If you don't know anything about it, stay away. You're liable to get us all in trouble. And, So that's my public service for tonight. Be that treason. I'm sorry. In fact, I've read some of these editorial writers here in town. I hope they don't get to the polls. I mean, talk about the ill-informed electorate. Wow. Some of these guys who write the editorial policies of these newspapers, I wonder where they get their information, if any. But nevertheless, the election in Britain was fascinating. Have you noticed that people that were in the instant world today, by instant, I've been noticing a thing that newscasters were saying tonight, that the presidential, the election and the time that it takes to elect a president seems too long for people today. What do they want? They want the guys to come out and make two speeches and that's all over and then we vote? I mean, I'm sorry, Les, it's not too long for me. In fact, I would like to hear another couple of months of these two guys talking. I feel that the election is not any too long at all. It's only boring to people who really are not really interested in elections and who don't really listen to speeches. In fact, I'll tell you this, that a nonsensical speech often tells you more about a candidate than a sensical one. And people somehow seem to get irritated when the candidate comes along and he does a terrible speech. I say, listen to that terrible speech. You know more about the guy than when he comes out with a good one. Seriously. And I don't think that our campaign trail is too long. How long is it? It seems like only yesterday that the whole thing went on out in San Francisco and Atlantic City. Wasn't too long. And now we're about to elect the president. This is a historical move. And it should be given a little time. Everything today is people are worried about time. Baseball is too long. 2 hours and 10 minutes is too long for a ball game. So, you know, this is not a good game anymore. Football, well, now that's a little bit better. But now watch, they'll be complaining pretty soon that they should only have two quarters in a football game. Sure, it's too long. Keeps you away from your martinis and all that stuff. And the important things you'd be doing on Sunday afternoon. Everything is getting too long to people. And when I hear people say that about a presidential campaign, then I worry. And I also worry when the important things of our time are reviewed on the radio and television page and not on the page of the editorials. Did you notice that the debate between the two senatorial candidates here in New York was reviewed on the radio page in the Times? That's significant. It's a good show. Very good show. Congratulations. Barry Gray pulled a coup. Great show, Barry. It's a little more than the show, friends. But nevertheless, we're coming full circle. You know, speaking of shows, I love to collect great cliches in the editorial context and also in particularly in the days of... there's no better day for the reaper of the cliché, the collector of the cliché, than during an election. It's as ritualized and as stylized today as a Western, as the traditional ballet. And tonight I heard a guy do it. He says, Barry, I would like to state at this time that I am saddened, my heart is saddened, that this campaign has degenerated into a campaign of smear and innuendo. I have striven at all times to keep the campaign on the issues and the important questions, but my ridiculous, my dishonest, sneaky pickpocketing opponent has dealt only in personalities. I... And I thought, well, you know... You know, it's funny when you listen to a political argument that the other guy's facts are lies, always. They're dodging the issue. And anytime you come up with your particular lie, it is called a deep insight into the issues and the problems at hand. And it goes on and on. And I enjoy it. As far as I'm concerned, the political wars are one of the most exciting things that a man faces or deals with in his lifetime. I think this is why people get so involved in it. 3 days after a president is elected, they hardly remember anymore all the stuff. You remember when everybody was all excited and fist-fighting and yelling in the street when Kennedy was running against Nixon? And then it was all over, and it was like 3 days later, you know, it was the country went on. I wonder how... I'd like to be able to count on... just the number of people, ever since I've been old enough to hear and listen and to understand vaguely what's going on around me. Every last election that I can remember, there have been large numbers of people around me say, if that bum is elected, I am getting ready to leave the country. I have already bought my ticket. And the same crowd is still around, still yelling it. I have not known one guy to leave the country. I did know one guy that went out for 2.5 days and his money ran out and he came back. I felt a little silly, you know. He got in a canoe and rowed towards Honolulu. And, got seasick and turned around and came back and figured he'd wait a couple of more days and he'd wait till good weather. And he's still out there now. He's selling canoes, by the way, on the beach for those who want to row to Honolulu. But, just maintain a little semblance of perspective. That, believe me, no matter who gets elected, you will not have to leave the country tomorrow. And if you did, it wouldn't do you any good, friend. You'd still be an American, and you'd still get bugged when you get to England. I did. Wouldn't do you any good. You're not going to escape mankind. And furthermore, to be perfectly objective as I can be about it, which is not any more objective than any other human being can be, who has, whose eyes pop out and whose ears sweat whenever politics are mentioned. These guys throwing rocks through windows. Me, I find that the American population has almost as great a misunderstanding of the presidency as the English, or maybe it's the other way around. I can't tell, but it seems to most Americans that if you elect, we're not really electing a president; we're electing a dictator. Large numbers of people think that that you elect this guy, and tomorrow morning he can cause a war. Or if you elect this guy, tomorrow morning everything's going to be happy, there will be no segregation problems, and everybody will be, pleased. Or either that, or if you elect this guy tomorrow, there's going to be riots in the streets, or whatever it might be. And yet, I wonder just how much power that a president has. In fact, Kennedy was in for 2 years before his tragedy and got very little actually accomplished, actually through. The president today is not... of course, the president in our system never has been like any other world ruler. You probably are aware that the British prime minister, when he is elected, when his party goes in, he appoints a government, literally. Isn't that true, Jeff? He appoints a government. Well, believe me, whoever's elected tomorrow will not appoint a government. I can assure you of that. He would like to, maybe, sometimes. They get pretty teed off, but they're not going to appoint any government. And the British somehow think that the American president is something like a cross between Charles de Gaulle, who was practically an absolute ruler. France has always had absolute rulers of one kind or another, no matter what their system seems to say, it always winds up with one guy standing on top of a giant platform with a bunch of other guys running around down the bottom and getting mad and trying to knock them off. I had a Frenchman talking to me about that the other day in England. He was talking about America, being a violent country. He says, you've had five presidents and you had this, the assassination. Well, for crying out loud, how many times were guys trying to shoot De Gaulle in the past year? He went around in an armored car. You remember there were guys under every bush there for a while. You remember that? In fact, they shot his Citroen a couple of times full of holes there like a sieve. And he forgot all about that when I said, well, what about this? He said, oh, well, that's De Gaulle. So, well, that's... you don't know which way what to turn, but it is an exciting thing. And I remember some of the great election nights. Do you ever think back on a great election nights of the past? I remember one time. I mean, where you were doing what went on around you during an election? I remember working in a radio station. I was in college, as a matter of fact, and I used to work in the station that was owned by a political candidate. And before the days this was just a guy's investment, that's all. It was that's it. He owned this radio station, and he was a rock-bound Republican. And in fact, it was just a known fact that everybody in the station was going to vote this absolute straight ticket right down the line. Everybody walked around with a smile of righteousness, that we were going to rot the rascals out and all that stuff, and the whole business. And the boss would come in and he would rally the troops, And he didn't exactly say that if we didn't vote for his candidate, we'd get fired. He did imply strongly that if the candidate did not win, his candidate, that we might be holding auditions the day afterwards, because he would suspect. And so, you know, everybody, oh, yeah, I'm telling you the truth. So everybody sat around, you know, they were all out campaigning for the candidate. Everybody was jockeying, trying to get a good spot on the schedule, you know, and everything. Well, I don't have to tell you that what happened was that night, everybody sneaked out to vote. And they all went out, and guess, you know, I don't even have to tell you who they voted for. They did not vote for the candidate that the boss was for. And so that night when we all sat around and the returns were coming in and the big man was sitting across from the microphone from me, you see, he was a famous senator and he would come on and make statements. I would be sitting there and I would get the cue from NBC and they would say, now we take you to the Midwest where Senator Watanabe will tell you what he thinks, how it's going out there. And I would say, and now, ladies and gentlemen, speaking to you from the studios, here is Senator Alfred M. Watanabe. And he would say, well, upon the basis of our early returns, we are confidently feel here at headquarters that when the returns from the western states begin to come in, that the tide will, well, you know, the old hogwash, and the organs were playing behind him, and the mouth harps, and this, I could hear somebody playing an accordion down the street, you know, and the violins were playing. Of course, he knew that they were going down to defeat, and so did we. And when it was all over, they had this giant victory celebration there. They had hams and everything. And I can remember the staff all standing around eating the pickled ham and drinking the beer and a couple of little bunting, and the trio was playing over in the corner and nobody showed. But the senator himself was delighted. He was delighted, and he was absolutely out of his mind with happiness because he had wanted the nomination. And even though his party went down to ignominious defeat, he had won. So I learned a little bit about politics that night, which I've never forgotten. Our great party, it's great because it's nominated me. It's a pretty rotten party when it doesn't nominate me. But I remember another election. I remember the one in the Army when Roosevelt was running his last term. And everybody was sitting around, and the returns were coming in. And it was a very peculiar, curious kind of election. That was the kind that you can't really describe because by present-day standards, because first of all, Cronkite wasn't there. It's very hard, you know. We didn't know exactly who to cheer for or what. Cronkite wasn't around, and Brinkley and Huntley were in the future. You know, they were just plain ordinary votes and elections and guys giving speeches, and in those days you could hear the guys give speeches. Actually, when they gave speeches, you could hear them on the radio. You could actually hear them. They did not have a running commentary between Huntley and Brinkley over it, talking about the ladies' hats from the Ohio delegation and the funny sign up there on the balcony. And everybody, oh yes, you're going to hear a lot of that tomorrow night, I'm sure. A lot of extraneous stuff is going to be going on, and it's a big show. But I remember that election particularly because it was the first one that I really had any kind of actual involvement in, as far as not a matter of vested interest or not, but it just seemed to somehow involve you. And they were bringing in the returns, and we had no television set or anything like that. And the returns were coming in from headquarters somewhere, and they would come in over the signal corps receiver we had. And you'd hear a return, somebody would bring back a sheaf of paper from the signal center, and everyone would look at it, and slowly it became obvious that that the president, Roosevelt, was getting reelected, and everyone felt, and it wasn't that anybody was a Democrat or a Republican or anything, it just seemed like he was the chief, you know? He was the commander-in-chief, that was the end of that, and we would have felt very funny had there been another commander-in-chief. And even though it was a subtle thing, very, very peculiar, and you begin to wonder what the nature of leadership is, what it is that men see in other men that want them to be up on top, the intense desire that we all have to somehow have something to follow, to have something up there, somebody who somehow seems to know and is in charge, that has the reins in his hand. And have you noticed more and more that the campaigns are getting to the point now where we don't really concede that the candidates are actually human. Now, I mean in this sense, that that I literally believe that in the next 10 years or so, a candidate will charge another candidate with sneezing, which proves him to be mortal, which means that how can anybody who sneezes and has stomach trouble, how can any guy with a bad knee, how can he really do anything about the awful situation in Indochina or whatever it might be? We're looking for a god. We can't have guys that have bunions. I mean, believe me, if it ever comes out that a political candidate for presidency has a terrible case of bunions, I suspect there's going to be a tremendous to-do made about that in the next couple of years. Because more and more we're aiming towards the Superman. And it's curious the kind of... I suppose you say the combination of folklore and folk myth, all these things which go up to make up the drive or the urge that people have to elect this man, to believe in this man, or whoever it is. I'm not talking about any particular candidate, Goldwater or Johnson. It is an urge that is very mystical and goes all the way back to the earliest days. I suspect one of the really significant moments in mankind's evolution as an animal, as apart from all the other animals, was the day that he first, either by acclimation or a subtle process of elimination, the first leader was born. The first leader was created. I mean, up to that point, there were just a bunch of guys jostling around and hiding in the woods. The squirrels, who do not have leaders, as far as we know. The camels, we do not know who the leader of the camels is. And as far as we know, there is no leader of the camels. And no animals really have leaders the way men do. There might be the sexual head of a tribe of or a herd of animals. That's not quite the same thing. Not at all. No. A leader is something entirely apart and removed from the elk who has beaten all the other males and is now in charge of all the female elk. Which is literally what a herd evolves into or comes out of. No, there was a moment in time when everyone said, you know, there's a lot of trouble around here, around the cave. Boy, look at that wind blow. Look at all them trees are falling down out there. And that terrible lake out there. And look at the shark out there. We better get somebody who's in charge. And there was this little guy scrunching back at a rock over there, and he's wearing his leopard skin, and somebody says, well, what about Og? And Og is saying, well, I do not choose to run. And so the next thing you know, they're carrying him around on their shoulders, and everybody's cheering, and Og is the first. He's the first one in charge. Well, of course, a couple of days later, one of the tribesmen got bitten right in half by a shark. Well, immediately there was discontent began to settle. What about Og? Wasn't he supposed to do something about this? What about this? Well, then a couple of days later, somebody got belted on top of the head with a coconut, and he's dead. And the discontent, the winter of discontent, begins to set in. And sure enough, by the fall, Og is served up for dinner one day. And a new leader is elected. and up to this point, I was listening to some of the most fantastic drivel tonight, being given as serious commentary. Like, for example, you don't like what's going on in Southeast Asia? Well, do something about it. As if the guy you elect can do something about the whole world. The implication that if you don't like what's going on in Russia, elect A. Oh, yeah? You're in for an awful, awful serious disillusionment if you elect A and Russia continues to be Russia. I heard one guy say, well, you know, you're looking for issues. You don't like what's going on in China? Well, you know, well, then make... Well, I'm not so sure that by electing somebody one way or the other, you're going to be able to make China fly away. This is one of the great, sad facts of life, and you just have to face it. I think one of the most interesting things about our elections in recent years is our tendency to be disillusioned 15 minutes after the inauguration. Believe me, do you know that the poor Kennedy, 15 minutes after Kennedy was sworn in, already the cartoonists were preparing the first anti-Kennedy cartoons, primarily because they had a sneaking suspicion already that they had not elected a god. Somebody could hurl thunderbolts and change the world by moving his hand. or by sending out great waves of dark clouds that would wipe away all injustice or whatever it is that they're against. And we're, this growing tendency in American life to blame external problems on the president could very well lead us into some very, very deep and devious political waters. Eventually somebody will come up and say, well, all right, you've had all this problem. Put me in charge now, at last. I will take charge of all those things. And look out. Look out. There's been other guys that have done that before in the past. I'm just saying here that it is a tendency, and this is not a political, this is actually an apolitical show tonight. But listening to these speeches has been, again, a revelation to me how closely and how further we're drifting in that direction. If there is a wild situation, if tomorrow morning, believe me, if tomorrow morning the just name it, if the government of Peru decides to blow up the castle, that would be blamed on one or the other of the candidates. It really would be. That somehow he should have done something about this, or should have known something. And this is a dangerous problem, because what we're really implying there is that the man in office should be and really is a Superman if he's a good president. If he's a good president, he can really take care of all the trouble in the world if he's good. He can deal with all the problems of America if he's good. And if he doesn't take care of those problems, if he does not make all the problems go away, it shows, one, he's incompetent, two, he's a crook, three, he's covering up. And this is the way it is in America. It is a firm belief. And of course, another one of the strong drifts that is evidenced in, incidentally, all parts of the world, I heard it in England too, was to blame the 20th century, literally, to blame the 20th century and the conditions of the 20th century on whoever is in the opposite party. In short, if you don't like the way the traffic is, it's that rotten mayor. No one would ever admit that there is 18 million too many cars or the fact that the streets are too narrow. It's the mayor that's doing it. He's making it like that at 6 o'clock. He's making it so you don't get a cab. And this is a fascinating development. It really is. People have lost perspective. I guess we've drifted so far from reality that we like to think that life itself is a big TV script, and Paddy Chayefsky should write it better. And that if it doesn't come off the way it should come off, it's because somebody is, again, lousing up. It's a deliberate attempt on somebody's part to nobble you, to hamper the good, simple little man who only wants to live in peace. And now they're covering up again. the great they. This is fascinating. I hear more and more political commentators with a straight face somehow implying that politicians are a separate breed apart, roughly akin to the mafia. Yeah, it's a fascinating thing too that's coming around. And these are so-called intelligent men, and yet they continue to promulgate this guff, and they're applauded. And the more you say that, the more you will be applauded. Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. The more you imply that all candidates, all politicians are crooks, the more you will be considered a deep and serious thinker on the subject of politics. And yet, of course, it's a patently ridiculous thing to say, and yet it never seems to occur to people. And I know a lot of people out there are going to be young. What do you mean they're all our crooks? Well, if you think that, man, you're setting yourself up for a man who will come years from now and who will say, yes, that's true, all politicians are crooks. Elect me, I'm not a politician. And he'll look out at you with his stainless steel fangs gleaming in the dark, and you will elect him because you will finally say, at last a guy's come along who is not a politician. And we know, we define all politicians as crooks. And so at last a non-politician has come along, we're going to elect him and keep politicians out of office. In fact, that is exactly the program that Hitler ran on, you know. He did. He did. He says, get all those rotten politicians out. Put a good man in. A simple man of the people. Well, I don't know whether I'd like to put my lot in with the simple man of the people. And incidentally, what is so wrong with being a professional politician? You know, we honor professional men in every field. We honor professional men in law. We honor professional men in medicine. We honor professional men in every possible area, including radio. We like to hear professional radio people around. We like to hear and see professional actors. And somehow to call a man a professional politician is to tell him he's a crook. Well, I'm sorry. Politics is a highly complex business, extremely complex business. And I like to see it in the hands of a few politicians who know something about it. I'm sorry. We have some of the greatest curses that have ever hit us is once in a while when the simple-minded amateur gets in charge. And there have been several in our past history. Grant was a classic example. Just a plain, ordinary amateur in the world of politics. And boy, it showed. For those of you who are interested, of course, you know, history is there. And we've had several examples, some of them even more recent than that. But somehow the amateur is applauded in politics. Why? I don't know. It's one of those myths that's grown up that somehow with amateurism goes honesty. Oh, does it? Oh, I've known some pretty sneaky amateurs in my time. Oh, in every field. Amateur sports, amateur this, amateur folk singing, amateur everything up and down the line. Amateurism does not automatically convey and give to the person who is the amateur honesty, reliability, and insight, certainly not that. And yet, this is one of the myths of America. Tomorrow, at this time, it'll probably be all over, or at least the votes will be cast. It may not be over with us. We may not know, but it will be, in effect, over. And I hope that enough people who are going to vote have listened to some of the speeches. And if you didn't listen to the speeches, if you don't know what you're voting for, look out. I wonder at this attitude on the part of so many people in public life today that voting is in itself a positive virtue. That's a questionable thesis. So may the best man win. And I'll tell you this, after it's all over, let's all pretend he's the best man anyway, because that's about all we can do. And cynic? No, I'm not. I am not so cynical as to feel that whoever gets elected, I am going to have to leave the country 20 minutes later. If that's the case, our country is in a very bad way. Our system of government is a very shoddy system of government. If one man can get in and completely turn it into where you got to jump into a birch bark canoe and take off for Oceania. If that's the case, well, we deserve to go to Oceania, all of us, floating in a rubber raft with a leak in it. I am not the one to claim that if Goldwater or if Johnson gets elected, I'm not going to throw any towels in at any of it. And one thing, if the wrong guy gets elected and you feel you've got to leave the country, that's the time to stay and fight it. Don't chicken out, for crying out loud. Either that, Star-Spangled Banner and all of it, old man. Chin up, you know. It's going to be all right.